to On the Mic with Mike Peters. My guest this week is Carson Taylor, a comedian in Mobile, Alabama. Carson's been doing stand-up for 10 years. His buddy Zeke Buchholz convinced him to give it a try back in 2014, and has been at it ever since. Carson got sober 6 months ago and is feeling the positive effects already. He runs Whippersnapper Comedy with Josephine Rivera and has been producing shows for about a year. I had a great time talking to him. Please like, share, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Follow Homebrewed Comedy on Facebook and go to homebrewedcomedy.com for all of my show dates. Thanks again. I'll talk to you guys next week. Take care. Off in stacks. I'm peeling back my sunburnt skin. I'll wait outside your bedroom. I hope they let me in. Thank you so much for doing this, man. Appreciate you taking time.
For sure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. What would you be doing? It's right now, it's Wednesday afternoon. What would you be doing on a regular day?
Well, right now I am off work today. During the day, my day job is I'm a line cook at a po' boy restaurant in Mobile, Alabama. So during the day I do that. At night I do jokes. So honestly, if I wasn't doing this right now, I'd probably be trying to write dumb bits about socks or something and drinking coffee. That'd be about it.
I went down to New Orleans and that was the thing. It was the po' boy. Like,
yeah.
Everybody's like, you got to have one. And God, it was a shrimp po' boy at one point. Man, what the hell? I had it memorized at one point, but it was amazing. And it was the only thing, I'm sure it was like, you know, had some sort of seafood concoction in it because it was right in the center of New Orleans. But is that the big thing down there?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely like New Orleans and Mobile, the big things like Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
And then definitely like Cajun and Southern food, the combination. A lot of blackening seasoning down here and a lot of meat in your vegetables. So
when people come to visit Mobile, where do you take them? What is the thing that you need to see when you go down there?
Man, you know, honestly, like my favorite part of Mobile has always just been the downtown area because you're still nearby the water. We have the causeway with restaurants on it and you can see our battleship, the USS Alabama. But I just love I've always been a downtown area. I just enjoy the downtown area because there's so many nice local shops and restaurants and, you know, parks and stuff. It's just a nice little area.
When people come to Binghamton and it does happen, I know. Your girlfriend's in Poughkeepsie, so you'll be up in the area eventually, maybe.
Yeah.
Whenever somebody comes here, I'm like, okay, well, we have this pizza place. We have that pizza place. Also, the Italian food's good here. Oh, we have another pizza place. Like, that's it. Like, we have Italian and pizza. And I'm not embarrassed by it, for sure. But, like, you can take a look around our town and be like, oh, yeah, I could tell everybody here likes pizza. We're a big people. But that's it. Like, we have history. But it's not a big city, and the buildings aren't super impressive. So you're like, well, let's go get fat over here.
Yeah, we have like three tall buildings. There's a beautiful area because of our trees, and we have Spanish moss growing off everything. And like, it has a nice kind of like haunting beauty to it at night and everything. But like, food-wise, it's like our big thing down here is like gumbo and like jambalaya and stuff like that. And it never strikes me. I always forget that, like, not everybody has gumbo. So, like, when people actually come down here, like, I've met people that are like, what the hell's gumbo? And I'm like, really? Like, because I'm just so used to it. It's, like, it's just been a part of my diet, basically, growing up.
Is it basically stew? Like, it's a soup product, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like you make a roux where you just take some flour and oil, you know, and then you, like, cook that until it's, like, a nice dark brown. And then gumbo is basically, like, a Creole or like African word for okra.
Okay.
So like you have lots of okra in it and then like shrimp, oysters, crab, whatever you can throw in there. But yeah, it's basically just like a brown soup with seafood, honestly.
My girlfriend will send me to the store to get certain vegetables and okra is one of those where she hasn't done it yet. But if I saw that in the list, I would be so intimidated because like I'll have to Google it. Thank God Google exists, but I'd have to Google to make sure I was getting what okra is. Like, I had to buy kale one time, and I'm like, that's lettuce, right? And she goes, not really. I'm like, okay. I had to find shallots. She wanted me to buy shallots, and I swear to God, I was mad because I'm like, are you inventing vegetables? because in my 40 years of life, I never heard of what a shallot is. And I'm like, she's like, it's like a little onion. I'm like, okay. I'm like, I'll take your word for it. But
it sounds like something a percussionist uses. Like, exactly. Yeah, don't forget my shakers and my shallots.
Yes. And I'm like, this is unreal. And I'll like, she laughs about it, but there was, I forget what fruit it was. Palmetto. It was a palmetto.
I've never even heard of that.
Right. And that's where my frustration comes in. How old are you?
I'm 30.
You're 30. Okay. So I was 40 at the time. And I'm like, how are they hiding fruits from me? Like, it's this palmetto. Huge. It looked like the size of a head. And I was at the store and it had no tag on it. So I didn't know what it was. And it was by, I mean, I knew it wasn't a cantaloupe. And it was by a watermelon, I guess. But like, I was like, what is this? And she goes, oh, it's palmetto. I'm like, no, it's not right. Like, I felt like such an idiot, but I'm like, I've had fruit before, but I didn't know this existed.
Yeah, I know someone who like always, like anytime we go, they buy the strangest fruits like that. Like, they'll get some kind of dragon fruit or like, I've gotten pomegranate flavored things.
Yes.
But just a couple months ago was the first time I saw someone chop into a pomegranate and open it up. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, it looks like you discovered some like a bunch of rubies or something. It's the craziest. Just like the tiniest little seeds. And you're like, no, you just rip those out and eat those for days. I'm like, all right, it's pretty good.
My last girlfriend, she bought a pomegranate and a dragon fruit. And the dragon fruit looked kind of gnarly to eat.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't want to. I'm sure it's good, but I was like afraid to try it because it just looked odd. I was like, same with the pomegranate. Like, I'm like, no, that's okay. I'll keep with my pear.
Yeah, I was like, I did not develop taste buds, honestly, until like the last 2 years of my life. Like, I had like the worst, unless it was like, even when it came to fruit, like a kiwi, like unless it was a Capri Sun, like I was not having kiwi in my life. You know what I mean? Just little things, anything that had hair on it. I was like, it freaks me out. I don't want that. Right.
I'm at the point now where like, I remember liking peaches and nectarines and things like that. But if it has like a fur on it, I was like, do I want to do that again? Like, I remember liking it as a kid, but I don't know if, as an adult, if I want to do that.
Yeah, well, when I was a child, I had like a deep fear. Like, my three biggest fears growing up as a kid were tornadoes, spiders, and heights. Oh. And so, like, the idea of anything that felt like a tarantula, like, no way, dude. Like, I couldn't do it.
So, were you able to watch Home Alone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Loved it. See, you know, the weird thing about fears that I've noticed is like, even though I was afraid of things like that, I would want to get as close. Like, one of my biggest things as a kid was I always wanted to see a tornado, like out in like in some open field where no one got hurt or something. Like, I always wanted to see that, even though it was like a deep fear of mine for a tornado to hit my house or something, even down in Mobile, Alabama. Like, I don't know why that was such a big fear of mine. But it's a weird thing. It's like, even though I was scared of these things, I almost wanted to try to get as close as possible to them in a weird way, you know?
Like, so you literally could have a hurricane every year.
Yes, this is true.
Of that.
Well, no, because like, I don't know, having hurricane parties is so much fun. Like, that's down to this. Yeah, that's a big thing down here that people do. It's like, you get your friends that you want to shack up with for a few days in case the power comes out, and everybody just gets as much alcohol and drugs and stuff as possible, and then it's just like, for 48 hours, 3 days, everyone just kind of hangs out. Like, if your phone's charged, you have a Bluetooth speaker, you play music, and you just ride out the storm as a group. That's a lot of fun down here. I've done, like, the past three hurricanes, I have the same buddy's house that I go to, where, like, six of us all just spend the night for 2 days and just, like, have a good time.
It seems awesome. From the outside, it seems. Now, I've done that with blizzards, but we know we've got a blizzard. We're kind of there. You're brave. The morning trip, you're like, all right, well, I have no work for the next 2 days. I'm going to hang out at your house. So we do that here. But when I hear a hurricane party, I'm thinking like, well, your house might blow away.
Well, here's the thing. And you know what area you're in. So like, if it's like a category 3 and it's mainly hitting like, you know, 4 hours away, it's like, okay, we're definitely going to get some wind and rain and stuff, maybe some power issues. So you'll have a party then. If it's like a category, if it's like a Hurricane Katrina coming for us, like, you're with your family and you're like, man, this is probably going to be really scary. Like, let's all stick together here. So you definitely know what category you're dealing with before you're like, hey, this one's going to be fun for us.
When you were in school, did they have like hurricane drills?
Man, you know what's funny? I remember doing tornado drills and fire drills. I don't know if we ever did a hurricane. I guess we would probably just treat it the same as a tornado drill because that's usually the big, at the end of the day, like, I think that is the biggest fear is that, like, a lot of tornadoes get spun out of hurricanes. So I feel like we've just prepared the same way if we did. But I don't remember if we ever specifically did a hurricane drill. That's interesting.
We never had anything like that. We did fire drills and when we, I don't think it was a drill, but when we were in high school, we started getting bomb threats. So we're like, all right.
The Northeast. Yeah, way more than down here. So that's true.
I think it was mainly kids just fucking around. But yeah. Like, you know, they'd call in a bomb threat because they'd want to take their algebra test. But like, we did that. But you don't, there's no drill for it. It's like, fuck, somebody called in a bomb threat. You got to get out. So
yeah,
that's all we had. And, but I graduated high school. My freshman year of college was 9/11. So I don't remember having any active shooter drills, nothing like that for terrorist attack. I don't know what they did after that, but no. So we just had the fire alarms and then the occasional bomb scare where you just walked en masse to a church or a boys and girls club, like depending on which school you were. It's like, all right. Cause yeah, they're not going to bomb a church. That would never happen.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I remember one time there was a bomb threat when I was like in middle school, and I think it was the high school that was across the street, McGill, because I went to a Catholic school called St. Mary's. It's like the oldest school in Mobile, Alabama. I think it was founded in 1863.
Oh, wow.
And then everyone usually, there's like 11 Catholic schools, like elementary and middle schools in Mobile, and usually everybody kind of crosses over to McGill-Tulane. And I think there was a bomb threat at McGill-Tulane in like 2006 or something, but it was just like a group of students like playing a prank. I don't think it was anything serious.
I wonder if like people probably get in trouble for that stuff, but like I've never heard of anybody getting in trouble. Like we had the bomb, unless they were credible threats, which I can't imagine that anybody in 1997 wanted to seriously blow up Union Endicott High School. Like I never heard about somebody getting arrested, or maybe the technology wasn't as good then.
Well, I'll say a person, so he shall remain nameless. a friend of mine that I've known for like 15 years, and I don't know, never talked to him about it. Don't know if he actually did it. I don't know what happened, but like 3 or 4 years ago at a college, he got arrested for calling in a terrorist attack or bomb threat or something. And I don't know if it was a prank or if he just, I don't know if he's like the first guy and then it turns out he didn't do it, but it was the weirdest situation and I've seen him since, but of course I'm not going to be like, hey, how have you been? What was up with that? this is not the first thing that's going to come out of my mouth. So I don't know. It was strange though, but also weird because he's the nicest human being you'll ever meet. So it was like, it made no sense to any of us. We're like, him? Like, I don't believe that.
He was probably just bored.
I guess so, or maybe he's like super shit faced with some friends and just like, this will be hilarious, and then you wake up at 6 a.m. and you're like, that was not hilarious.
Well, how do you like Mobile?
Hate love relationship. I feel like it's kind of like that with any place that you've been in your whole life, because like I've lived in Mobile since I was 3, so like 27 years or something, 3 or 4. So there's things about it I love. There's things about it that I hate. Sometimes because of stand-up, I wish that I was in a bigger city like Atlanta or, you know, New Orleans, New York, anywhere. But there's things also about it that are nice. It's a nice little quiet place where everybody knows each other. And people always imagine it's going to be smaller than it is. Like when you actually get to Mobile, you're like, oh, this place is actually pretty big. And it's like, yeah, it's not like tiny, tiny. But I don't know. It's got its own weird energy. Like people like move and they always come back. No one can ever like leave Mobile forever. Like someone like you're born there, you live there till like your 20s, and then you're like, all right, I'm gonna go experience the world. And then when it's like time to die, you crawl back in your Mobile cave and like you know, read the walls that you used to paint. You pass on. Well,
that's a college town too, right?
Yeah, we have South Alabama. And then Mobile College, and there's a few like community colleges. So the South Alabama Jaguars, that's the biggest school down here.
I don't know why I thought it's not. Obviously, Alabama is, I forget what town that is.
Tuscaloosa.
Tuscaloosa, okay. I don't know why I can never remember that. Like, there are certain college football teams or basketball teams where, like, you know, they come up and, like, I'll read a story and I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Like, Tuscaloosa, or whatever. But for some reason, I don't remember it. It just, I want to say, like, Birmingham. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's basically all towns down here are pretty much like Indian names that Southern people pronounce wrong, you know? Okay. Like, I feel like if you look up the real meaning of Tallahassee, it's probably spelled completely different, but we spelled it the way that Southerners would say, like, Tallahassee. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, New York, all of our, like, a lot of the names, like, the upstates, like, Syracuse and Onondaga, towns like that, like, we just took their names, like, fuck it. Nobody even knows if we're spelling it correctly, we're pronouncing them correctly. Just, they're ours anyway. We took them from you.
Yeah, like, it's almost like rubbing it in your face even worse. It's like, we stole this from you, but we're going to keep it your name, though, because that's pretty cool. We like the way that rolls off the tongue, Syracuse.
But we'd really appreciate it if you go into this little area and, you know, maybe we'll give you a casino. That's it. It's very cruel.
Yeah. It's like your kid gets a stepdad and takes his last name. You're like, ouch.
When did you start doing stand-up?
10 years ago when I was 20. I still remember the date. It was October 8th, 2014.
The day your life
almost 10 years.
The day your life changed for the good?
I think so. I mean, here's the thing. It's like stand-up comedy is such a struggle. Like, you meet people who are like, if you ever meet someone who just like doesn't do anything that has to do with like entertainment or stuff like that, and they ask you like, what's it like being a comedian? And you really explain like, oh man, I drive like 6 hours to this show and I get paid like $80 and I'm eating off the dollar menu and staying at cheap places or rest areas. And they're like, oh, I couldn't do that. And I'm just like, man, I love it. Like, this is the, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm choosing to struggle, but also it makes me happy. Like, I enjoy it.
My girlfriend and I, right now, we have this routine where on Sundays we go to Taco Bell, and I'll go to Taco Bell, I'll bring it home. And I try not to do that after a show. Sometimes I will. I'm not a prude or anything, but I feel like it's a ritual thing where it's like, you know, I had 4 shows this week and I've worked hard all week. And this is the end. And it's like I got to the finish line and this is my reward. And then it gives me enough juice to be like, okay, let's do it again. I think there's something to that, and it's that lifestyle, like the comedian lifestyle is like such a vagabond thing, especially if you're on the road a lot, that you just take joy in those little things.
Yeah, it's true. And like, it's like, yeah, getting paid like an extra $50 because the audience like tipped you or whatever. It's like, oh my God, that's the difference between like so much. That extra $50 means everything.
Oh, all of my shows have like a tip jar to it. So like, we give a budget from the bar. We do ticket sales, whatever, but I always add a tip jar. So, like, I tell comedians when I book them, like, well, pays $100 plus tips, and you never know how much. And, like, last night, we got a substantial amount of money for tips, and I'm like, oh, my God, it almost matched the budget we had for the bar, like, the free
show.
And I'm like, oh, my God. So, like, on top of giving them $75 more or so, like, it's like, oh, I got more for me, and I might not have to work as much, like, on a real job. As much like I can coast a little bit more. So it kind of is nice. And when you see that $20 bill in the tip jar, you're like, really? You guys like us that much? Amazing. Yeah. I'll never get used to it.
Well, it's like, I used to always be like, I cook in a restaurant now, but I used to always be a server or a bartender. And like, you know, you kind of got to treat it like that. When there's tips, it's like, man, it's like, if you really give it your all and really connect with the audience on a human level and like treat it like how you would a table. Like, you know what I mean? And like, if you really give it your all, you'd be shocked at how, like, you know, the tip show. It's like great service. You know what I mean?
When you're a line cook, do you get any of the tips?
No. Okay. I just get paid hourly.
Okay. I didn't know. I never worked at a restaurant. I worked at a nursing home in the food service department. So I did like a tray line and all the prep stuff. Like, that's as close to a restaurant as I've gotten.
Line cook, I get paid hourly. Like, I love the situation that I'm in now just because the guy that I work with, or my manager, we're friends, and he's really cool, and he lets me get off work every day at 3 so I can go travel and do stand-up.
Oh, nice.
So I love my work situation right now. It's, like, perfect.
And you're 10 years in, so, like, I got to imagine that you're pretty comfortable with where you are and the journey. Like, maybe you want more, but it's like, you're kind of nestled into this lifestyle.
Yeah. No, I made the decision this year that it's like, I'm truly just going to go for it and give it my all and try to make this a career, which I thought would make things more stressful, but it's actually made things easier that I've really just set like the goal for myself. And so now it's just like working for it. My hardest thing to do is like, I'll book all these shows and like, there will be a big show like 3 weeks from now. And I'll find myself in the car driving, stressing about 21 days from now. And I'm like, why am I not just worried? Like, if I'm going to worry about anything, just worry about tonight.
Yeah.
Knock out tonight, then tomorrow, then the next day. But sometimes I'll be like, oh Lord, I'm doing that open mic at the Laughing Skull. And I'm like, shit. I'm like, that's May 1st. Like, why am I freaking out right now for no reason? Like,
so what took you so long to say, okay, well, all right, now it's time. Like 10 years in, you say, okay, I want to make a career. I mean, I'm sure you had that thought a few years ago, but why now?
Oh, because I lost sight of the goal and I got like, I'm like 6 months sober right now. Okay. From drinking. And so like when I first started out when I was 20, I was like, my first 3 years of comedy, I took it extremely serious. Like in Mobile, we barely had any comedy 10 years ago, like on the Gulf Coast. And I've found a way to get on stage sometimes like 9 times a week, like doing music open mics or poetry open mics, like whatever I could find that they would let me tell jokes, I would do it. And then I was a caretaker for my grandpa for like 5 years, right? And then my grandpa passed away and it destroyed me, dude. And I started drinking so heavily. And then for like 4 years, I just got on stage once a week and did the same 10 minutes for the most part. I would still write a little bit, but I was writing like 2 new jokes a month as opposed to 2-3 new jokes a day. So, yeah, I literally just like I got caught up in depression and I lost sight of the goal. And then quarantine happened. So there was nothing going on. And so, yeah, I just let negativity in my own head get in the way and kind of like take me off course a little bit. So the past year has been great because I've been a lot of just working on myself.
Did you have like a wake up moment with the drinking? We're like, okay.
Yes, I did. October 26th. So I've tried to quit a few times. I think it was like the biggest thing is I read this book recently called Push Off From Here. And this lady, I can't remember her name, it was about Lauren McCowan. She wrote it. And it changed my life. I bought it the first day that I quit drinking. And I had tried quitting before and I could only make it to 3 months. And then I'd go back because my brain would convince myself that I was like, no, you're good now. You got it figured out. And so there's always like the shame when you go back to drinking again that you can't shake, or you're like, oh, like I kept feeling like I was doing something wrong. And then October 26th, I blacked out really bad and won an open mic competition, but I don't really remember it, but that was cool. But my prize was a $50 bar tab, so that didn't help me at all. So I'm already pretty much blacked out. And then, yeah, I was a nightmare, dude. And I woke up the next day and I was like, man, I have got to stop living like this. Like, it was like in my head, it was officially the moment. And I watched a Bill Hicks documentary about him getting sober. And I realized, I was like, man, if I'm ever going to make it or even try to make it as a comedian, like, I cannot have alcohol in my life.
I have heard so many stories about, like, you know, comedians that I'm sure you listen to as well, but like guys who have made it who are sober. And I don't know if it's like just this one moment that catches me, but like there has to be a correlation between getting sober, especially for the guys who are really well known. It's like getting sober and then like their career is going okay. And then there's a switch and they just take off. Have you seen that with other comedians? Did that inspire you at all?
Yeah. Like my biggest inspiration, honestly, for getting sober was Joe List.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, he's one of my fucking favorite comedians, and I listen to his podcast, Mindful Morning Jacket, all the time.
Yep.
I've been listening to him for like the past 2 or 3 years, and a lot of the times I would try to quit, and then I'd go back, and I would always listen to him, and then like one, I don't know what it was, and like here's it. I realize you have to work every day at it. Like you can't ever think that like, oh, I got it now, because then that's when like all of a sudden a month later you're drinking again. So it does take work. But there was just that whatever happened at the end of October there, like I just had, as Jules in Pulp Fiction says, when alcoholics referred to it as a moment of clarity, like everything like made sense all of a sudden. And it was like, I know what I need to do. And so I've put in more work this time than I ever have with it before. Where before, the only thing I did was try not to drink, but I changed nothing else about my life. And now I've like made steps to like, okay, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to do yoga. I'm actually going to read this book on sobriety, like, you know, help myself, you know.
Do you feel healthier now, 6 months in?
Yes, I feel a lot healthier. I feel way better. Like, I wouldn't trade how I feel right now for anything in the past, because I would just get, like, dude, I'd get myself into so many crazy situations. I'd black out on stage and bomb, and, like, it was just, it was a nightmare. Like, how I walked away with not a single DUI, I'm like, that's one thing that I want to make sure. It's a big reason why I don't want to go back to drinking ever. That helps me not go back is remembering, like, man, I'm like, I have a perfect record with that.
Right.
So I don't want to screw that up. So how about just never do it again? Don't drink anymore. Don't drive. We're good. Like,
I would love to know the numbers of comedians to DUIs. Like, there has to be. It's like, at a certain point, you almost need one to belong, it feels.
It's crazy. Like, in Mobile, that's how it is, just to be a local Mobilian. Like, everyone I know has at least one. Like, when they find out I have zero, they're like, how? I'm like, I don't know. Yeah, right? Yeah, it's crazy. Like, everyone down there has DUIs as well.
Up here in, like, the Syracuse, Rochester, Binghamton not so much, but when I book shows, my first question is, do you have a car? A lot of times, like, no. And I don't ask why. I'm sure a DUI or some insurance non-payments or something, like, there's a reason. I don't ask the reason because it's not my business. But it's so crazy to me how so many of the local comedians don't have a way to get anywhere, or they're going to ask a friend. But I ask that question because, like, well, do I have to book you a driver as well? So,
yeah.
How do you do this? And, you know, it's just part of it. And I couldn't imagine being a comedian without access to a car. I mean, I can't ask for that much help.
That's what screwed me for the past 4 years before I started taking it serious again, or like life serious in general, because I was like drinking so much and like doing so much drugs and shit that like I never had money, so I couldn't afford to get a car. And then, so I would like walk an hour to work and an hour home.
Wow.
And, oh my God, dude, I was like a biggest, I would like, if I made $200 in tips, I would wake up the next day and have $40 because I would just blow 160 in one night and then walk home an hour and not even remember it. Like, it was chaos. So like, I couldn't even drive. If I got booked an hour away, I couldn't even, like, I started canceling so many shows. Like, basically what would happen, like, I feel like this happens to a lot of alcoholics, but you hit this moment of like drunk where you're sitting there and you just hate your life and you're like, I can't live like this anymore. And then of course the sun comes up and you're like, nah, I'll figure it out. I would have those moments where like, oh, what am I doing this? And I would like flush my drugs down the toilet. All my friends would be so mad. Like, you're good at giving that to me. Why are you wasting it? It's like, but I had to have that Norm MacDonald, like throwing my chips off of the, you know, off of the bridge feeling about it every time. And so fucking, I would constantly just get down on myself and be like, I got to do more. And then, but in that moment of like 3 a.m. drunk, I'd message a comedian that lives in a town early. He's like, can I get on a show? And they'd be like, yeah. And they'd be like, March 26th. And I'd be like, all right. And then March 23rd, I'd realize like, how can I have no money? I can't make that. And I would just end up canceling every show I got booked on like the week of. And I'm like, dude, I cannot do this anymore. I've got to change things. I got to get professional.
So I got it. Two questions for you. I'll ask the first, this one. Do you remember your first sober set on a show? Like, was there a difference for you?
I don't remember exactly the first one. I just remember the overall feeling of the first few was like super nervous.
Yeah.
But I had quit before, you know, a few times, like I think 2 or 3 times I had like taken like a 2 or 3 month break from drinking. And so I would do stand up in those 2 or 3 months. And so I knew I could still be funny. So I didn't have like the nerves of like I've lost being funny, but I did have the feeling of like, man, it feels different up here because I could feel everything instead of just like, you know, I feel like when you're too drunk on stage, you're like, well, as long as I remember my jokes, I'll be fine. But it's like I could feel every energy in the room and silences. You could really feel them and hear them and stuff. And I was like way more conscious of everything. So that was weird to be like, oh, wow, I'm like really present right now, as opposed to like kind of half being in the room and half being in my drunk mind, you know.
And second question is, how did you start to repair those relationships with the bookers that you canceled on? Like, how did you get them to trust you again?
Oh, they all have problems too. Everybody that I know is either doing something or trying to stop doing something or just quit doing something. You know what I mean? Like, So everybody, you know, we all get it. That's what is the one thing I love about comedy. Is like you can patch up relationships with time because they'll be like, nah, I was going through shit too. Yeah. You're cool. Sorry we argued that day. Like, you know what I mean?
I feel like in this scene, I'm one of the only comedians who's never like done drugs. And like, I'll drink occasionally, but see, I'm 41. I did so much of my drinking in my 20s that when I moved back to town as a 30-year-old, I didn't really have, like, my girlfriend's never seen me drunk. We've been together 3 years. One of her biggest goals is to see me drunk. I don't drink to excess anymore because I already did that. I did that in my 20s. So I'm kind of like, now when I drink, I hurt. So yeah. I don't want to do that. Like, I've learned my lessons dozens of times. Like, no. So when I go to a show and I'm waiting for a comedian, I get annoyed because like I don't have that problem. So I don't know. I don't know if I would have been as tolerant down there, but it's a different culture. Maybe I would have been, you know, doing drugs or drinking a lot down there if I was there too.
Well, Mobile, man, it's, and I don't know, I've never lived everywhere or really anywhere, but looking, Mobile is like, it's one of the heaviest drinking towns that I've ever like been in, like anywhere that I travel. Like our bars don't really close. So like downtown, we have a bar that like basically what everyone does is like a large group of people. We go to one bar that closes at 4 a.m. Yeah. And then we all travel to this other bar, like right down the road, because they close at 6 a.m. And then we go around the block to this other bar that doesn't close till like noon. So like when I was still drinking and stuff, it's like you could literally go downtown at 8 p.m. and then leave the next day at 11 a.m. You walk outside and it's birds chirping and bright lights and school buses driving by and you're just like, oh, God, I hate myself. So like I know a lot of comedians that have visited Mobile, like do a show downtown. Like, so what do y'all do for fun? And then we show them and at 3 a.m. they're like, dude, I got to go. Like, I can't do this anymore. We're like, no, we got like 3 hours left in us.
I mean, just doing shows around the area, I've gotten to know a lot of bartenders. And after the show, sometimes like I'll talk with the bartenders, and especially at my open mic, this is a couple years ago, but the manager would be like, oh, come on, hang out. And I would hang out. And then they wouldn't stop partying until like 5 o'clock in the morning. And that was their everyday routine.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I can't do that. Like, even then, I'm like, well, I don't have a day job to get up for, but like, I still want to be home by like 1:30 or 2. And every single day they were up drinking and like not, I mean, they were drinking, you know, like, so like, and they go to bed at 5. I'm like, I can't do that. No way.
Yeah. No, that's like, that was my life, dude, for like 5 years. Like that is all I did was stay up till sunrise, get 3 hours of sleep, go and work a double. At one point I had three. I remember my buddy Zeke, you know, Zeke Buckholson, he did this podcast, right? Yeah. Yep. I remember one time we make music together. We have a band called Shropshire Collective. We just did an album in October. So like we'll make beats and stuff and like make music together. I remember one time, so I had three jobs and I never had a day off. I'm top of partying and staying up to like 6 a.m. every day. And Zeke just looked at me one time. He's like, dude, how do you do it? And I was like, man. And that's one time at that time, it felt like a badge of honor. Like, I'm cool because I never have to take a break and I can party hard and work hard on stuff. And now I look back and I'm like, man, I should have been focusing on my goals. Like, what a waste of time. Like, it was crazy. Why was I doing that to myself? Now I have gray hair at 30. Like, I'm exhausted. Like, why? That was no fun.
My girlfriend will get on my case because I will only get 4 or 5 hours of sleep at most. And she is iron deficient, she says. I think it's an excuse. I think it's just an excuse to be able to nap more in the day. But she really, like, she'll take a nap. And I'm like, I don't understand how you nap. And then I take a nap. And I'm like, oh, I get it. Because it's awesome. But I'm like, I don't function that way. I'm like, once I'm up all day. I'm up for 16, 18 hours without sitting down. I mean, I sit down. But it's like, I don't need a nap. I can keep, as long as I'm busy, I don't feel tired.
Yeah.
When I do fall asleep, I'm okay for like 4 or 5 hours, then I need to get up again. But I've always functioned that way. I could do double shifts and then come home and play video games, whatever, and not give a shit about sleep. But I think that in part is genetic because my mom does that. My grandma did that. But
yeah,
you add the substances, maybe it's adrenaline that kept you going, where it's like, okay, well, because Zeke didn't know how I did that, oh, I'm just going to do it more.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's what I mean. Like it felt like I had a cape.
Yes.
On like, look, I'm Superman, and it's like, no, I'm like, eventually I'm going to turn into a villain if I keep living like this. This is like awful. And like, but I kind of was like raised like that too. Like my mom loves to party. She loves to have a good time. My dad was a deadhead. So like, growing up, I was raised on jam bands. Like he took me to see Fish when I was in high school and Widespread Panic in high school. And like, my dad's always been the GM of a restaurant and going to see jam bands, which means he also can function highly on little to no sleep after partying and having a good time. And so, yeah, I was kind of raised around that environment. And like, I make the mistake. And like reading that book on sobriety that I just finished was like huge. That push off from here, because like I could relate so much to the lady, because I have this problem where like I don't know how to enjoy my free time, because I feel like enjoying my free time means that I'm being lazy.
Yes.
And like there's not enough time to do everything that I want to do. So I have a hard time like reminding myself that it's okay to take a break, because I feel like I'm doing something wrong by literally doing nothing. You know what I mean?
I feel the same way. Yesterday. Yeah. I was watching Law & Order SVU. I was catching up on the new ones. And I looked around my apartment, and I'm like, oh, the desk should be cleaned. And I've got a Taco Bell bag there. I could take that out. And I've got cat toys that need to be cleaned up. And I'm feeling like an asshole because I'm watching TV when all this stuff could be – like, girlfriend's gone. I could be cleaning this up. So when she gets home, she's happy with me for once. But
yeah.
I don't. I'm like, let's just see what Olivia Benson is doing again. So, yeah, it's an internal struggle for me, too.
I have that problem all the time. Like, I feel like every comedian on every level feels like they don't write enough, and it's probably true, you know what I mean? But, like, I make the mistake all the time. It's like I get off work. I'm like, all right, what I'm going to do is I'm gonna do some yoga. I'm going to read a little bit of this book, and then I'm going to write for an hour. And then I will pull out my phone, and once I start the first Facebook reel, 4 hours go by, and I'm like, God damn it, it's 2 a.m. and I wasted this whole night on watching bullshit about sharks and alligators. Like, I hate that.
I don't want them to ban TikTok, but if they do, I would be so much more productive.
Yeah, I know. Like, I just, the phone steals away so much of my writing time, because it's like you just don't realize how glued you get to it so quickly.
Yeah, you'll say, okay, well, I'm going to watch this until 9:30. And then you look down and you're like, oh, it's 9:54. And it's, well, okay, might as well go till 10. It's like you lose another half an hour in what is like 2 minutes.
Yeah, it's awful, dude. Like I could have had a new 20 minutes of probably not great material, but something this month if it wasn't for my phone. But I have 3 minutes on briefs. It's
Well, you got your sock material, you got your brief
material. Yeah, you know, and that's what sobriety does to you. You know, I used to have like all my jokes would be like, let me tell you about the time I got out of this crazy situation. And now I'm actually like, man, I didn't realize how funny pencils can be. You know,
why isn't there a number 3?
Exactly. You just get Seinfelded really quick.
So you started doing stand-up at 20. What told you that you were like, why? I mean, did somebody tell you, hey, you're really funny, you should go? I mean, were the funny guy in the friend group?
Yeah, well, like I was always like the class clown growing up as a kid. I remember something that stuck with me my whole life was in the 7th grade. I had a teacher, Miss Hamlin, who told me one day, she was like, Carson, I'm gonna see you on TV one day. Like, I don't know if she meant cops or like, but I took it as a compliment. And so I was always like the class clown. Like my grades were always slacking because I was the kid talking in class instead of paying attention to his stuff. And somehow my friends could joke around just as me, but get their work done. I couldn't. I was always turned to my desk completely to the other side. And like, you know what I mean? Just talking one's ear off. But Zeke Buchholz, he was the one that convinced me. He started doing stand-up like a year before me. And I actually went to – we used to do comedy at Mobile at a place called the Blind Mule. That was like one of the hubs of like comedy down here on the Gulf Coast. I would go and see him. I watched him like 4 or 5 times there. And he would – every night he'd try to convince me. I'm like, man, you should do it. I really think you'd be good at it. You should try it. And then finally on October 8th, 2014, I signed up. And dude, my stuff was so hacky. Like, my first thing that I had when I got on stage was just a joke about the shirt I was wearing.
Right.
It's like I had to wear my joke with me. It was just a shirt of Cheech and Chong sitting in lawn chairs, just like looking out at the set of a movie or whatever. The joke was awful. It was just like a... You ever see these new kids that get into comedy? It's like every young person, when they start, they think that being NC-17 about everything...
Oh my God, yeah.
...is what comedy is. Dude, I was like the walking, living that for 3 years.
I think we all are at some point.
Yeah, like the first 3 years of stand-up, I was like, okay, comedy has to be about AIDS, cancer...
9/11.
You know, diarrhea, 9/11. Like, that's all that I had humor on. And so basically my joke was just like being able to get away with saying something was gay... Like, it was just one long buildup about a shirt to be able to say, that's gay. And then, but I got a couple laughs. And then I got enough laughs on it that I was like, huh, I'm going to try something else next time. And then I started figuring it out. And it's like, oh, you can actually, you don't have to be so negative about everything because you think that's going to get a reaction out of people.
Yeah, one of my favorite jokes now is, it's a comedian in Utica, is Will Phillips, really good. And been one of my favorite jokes for a while. But... he does a lot of Seinfeld-esque type things where he's like, yeah, I noticed they started making sour cream in a squeeze bottle as if the nightstand wasn't crowded enough. And you're like, well, okay. He goes, knocking down my Zimbalta. And it's such a great visual and so clean, just very, I mean, it's I think it's a perfect joke.
And like also people don't realize like you can create a really horrific, crazy image with just beautiful vocabulary. Like sometimes you don't have to go for like the darkest words in the dictionary to really like paint an image for people. Like what your childhood was like in a trailer park, or like, you know what I mean? You can literally just describe the sound of the roaches going up the wall. Yes. And that will really put an eerie feeling in people's hearts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, when you start out, you don't know that. I mean,
no, like, that does take a while.
That's why like people swear so much, and it's like, you know, we all think we're George Carlin, we all think we're Bill Hicks, but we're not. What we're doing is we're trying to be them, and we think fuck is really funny, and if you throw fuck around enough times, people are gonna laugh, and it ends up being like this crutch where it's like, okay, well if you can't get the joke to work cleanly, throw fuck in there, maybe that's the key. And sometimes it is, and then you kind of lean on it a little too much. And afterward, you're like, yeah, well, there's no substance.
Yeah, I feel like with, like, you know, like a Richard Pryor or a Carlin or Bill Hicks or somebody like that, I feel like when they use, like, if you go back to, like, the serving in a restaurant analogy, it's like, it's the cuss word is just the dish that the meal is served on.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's just what you're eating. It's the bowl that you're eating the Alfredo out of. But too many people try to... newer comedians make the cuss words the main dish.
Yes.
And it's not supposed to be. You know, if anything, it's supposed to be like garlic seasoning or something.
I think George Carlin's strengths was like, he didn't, unless he had a list of words, he didn't lean on the swear word. He used it as an accent mark. It's like, like it points you in the direction of his meaning. We're like, oh,
yeah.
Like it emphasizes it. So I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah, or like the way Richard Pryor would use motherfucker.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like this guy's cut. And he could literally say motherfucker 7 times in 4 sentences, but it never feels like the main point of what he's saying. He's like, it's like a watching Rodney Mullen do a kickflip or something. There's just something smooth about it. It just serves the joke a little bit better. It's like a nice garnish or something.
Right.
You look past it because it's just become such a part of his language.
So your first open mic is that October day. How did you feel?
Super nervous. I have really bad anxiety, and I still throw up before shows.
Oh, wow.
The first 3 years that me and Zeke did stand-up together, we would throw up before every set. It didn't matter how big or small the open mic or showcase or whatever. And sometimes still, like, if I drive to a city I've never performed at before and it's like a sold-out show, I will totally sneak out back real quick and just like, bleh. As soon as someone's like, hey, you're up in 10 minutes, I'm like, cool, I'll be right back. Throw up real quick and then let's get to it.
That's how you stay fit.
Yeah, pretty much, I guess. Or my doctor's be like, hey, you're destroying your esophagus. You might need to calm down a little bit. Like, all right, thanks.
I wonder if like the day you kind of don't need to throw up, if you're going to be worried about that. It's like, oh, no.
No, because
I don't my esophagus.
No, I don't throw up every time. It's okay. it's just some days, and I think it's just because like I overthink things, you know what I mean? Yeah. So if I start overthinking and I really start pacing back and forth, and then I get in my head about like, oh God, do you think they're going to like this? Or should I even talk about this? Should I do this? Then all of a sudden I'm like, oh man, I think I'm going to throw up. And people find that crazy. Like, you've been doing this 10 years. Like, you travel everywhere. How do you, I'm like, dude, I can't explain it. Like, it doesn't stop me. I've never gotten so nervous that I'm like, I can't get on stage.
Yeah.
It's just like, man, it just hits my stomach weird sometimes. I got to let it out and then just go up there and do my thing.
Do you think he's been a good force in your life? Like, I mean, has he brought you along, or was he kind of like, hey, I want to see you fuck up a little bit? Like,
no. No, he's super supportive, dude. That's my best friend. We've been best friends for 15 years or 16 years now. Yeah, I met him freshman year of high school. He had a broken femur. I didn't know anybody because I went to Catholic school and then went to this public school, and all my friends went to the same Catholic school. So I would eat lunch alone every day, and I would watch him. He would have to spend his entire lunch crutching from one class to the other. And so he had this giant cast on his entire leg from his broken femur, and he would just be struggling with his giant book bag. And one day I just walked up to him and I was like, hey man, can I walk with you and carry your book bag? And he was like, sure. And then we just walked together, and we found out that we both loved It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Nice.
And that was like the beginning of the end right there. We were friends forever.
That's so fucking weird. That must have been like the first season.
It would have been like, they had just started season 4.
No kidding. It's been that long.
Yeah.
Because they're in
– yeah, I think season 1 was like 05, 06, that's right, something like that.
They take it a couple years off here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so nuts that it's been on that long.
Yeah.
That it brought two people together 15 years ago, 16
years ago. It did. And then like, we had a whole class together for a year, and then one day I didn't even realize he had a band. He was in this band, Shropshire, and they were looking for a rapper. And they talked to my friend Curtis, and they were like, hey, can – you know anybody that can rap? And he was like, my friend Carson can rap. And he messaged me on New Year's 2010 on Facebook Messenger and was like, hey, do you want to come to band practice tomorrow and rap? And I was like, sure, but can I bring my guitar too? And he said, yes. And then I just didn't rap and played guitar the whole time. Joined the band.
Can you rap? So,
like a lot of our music, I would say like our music is like, very, I call it comedy trash can funk.
Yeah.
So like we do a lot of rapping. There's a lot of hip hop and funk, and like it's kind of like Chili Peppers, Sublime, Beastie Boys style music for the most part. We all rap a little bit. I used to rap a lot more when I was younger. I think when you're a white guy, unless you make it as a career, once you start getting in your 30s, you're like, I'm not going to be that dude that keeps a rapping on the side at like 36, you know what I mean? Like, if it's not my main job, eventually I'm just gonna switch to singing completely.
Get some face tattoos or something.
I can't do all that. I'm not wearing fluffy jackets and stuff. It's like, you know,
that's crazy. But, have you guys ever, you and Zeke, have you ever gotten like in arguments or because I?
Oh my god, all the time.
I still am like, I'm so lucky, but I've been best friends with my buddy Jeff. We met when I was 6. So it's 35 years. And we've had a couple arguments where, like, I wouldn't even say they're arguments. They were just like, he dated a woman and, like, didn't hang out with me for a winter break. And, like, he would always, like, around college time, he would always ditch me for
these
girlfriends.
And I'm that person in the friend group. I get in a relationship and then I'm nowhere to be found for 6 months.
I hate that. And, like, I went so, like, I remember I had a girlfriend. Who I'm in New York in Binghamton, and I had a girlfriend who was in basically Maryland, like very southern part of Pennsylvania, and she's 4 hours away. And my friend Jeff, his girlfriend lived in a neighboring town, so like he was 15 minutes away from her. He hung out with her every freaking day, never hung out with our group, and we always had wing night, and every Tuesday we go to wing night. Jeff was gone. He didn't message back, nothing. And I remember I went to visit my girlfriend 4 hours away, first time since the end of the semester. It's like, I don't know, early January, late December, one of the two. And I made a point. She's like, hey, you want to stay another day? I'm like, nope. Tonight's Tuesday. It's wing night. I've got to drive 4 hours away to make sure I am there because I know Jeff won't be there. And I wanted to say, this is the sacrifice I'll make for the guys, but he won't. So like, I remember when I moved away, we didn't talk for like 3 weeks. And I was like, fuck that guy. And eventually, like, I don't think there was like an apology. It was just like, fine, cool, we're good again. But like, that's probably the only real blip in our friendship over 35 years. So if you guys are good, like, pretty much throughout.
Oh, no, dude, we argue all the time, but it's just about stupid shit. And it's because we both create things together.
Yes. Yeah, it makes
sense. So it's like we work really well together. Like, when it comes to making music together, we, like, he just presents an idea and we just kind of yes and each other. And then, like, what we do is we kind of put all of our ideas into one barrel and then we just subtract together.
Okay.
Like, what's the pointless stuff that doesn't need to be there, you know, and then try to just simplify everything. But when it comes to music, we work really well together. It's like, it's the other stuff around it. When it comes, like, how should we promote this? How should we release this? Are you going to make this? Are you going to do this? All of a sudden, we'll, like, butt heads about anything. But also, I could be the worst, dude. If I don't eat food, I'm such a hangry person. So it's I'm one of those people that's like, if I've just woken up or I haven't eaten, I should just turn my phone off.
Right.
Because I feel like I'm just going to come across with an attitude. And it's like, as soon as I'll eat one apple and be like, man, my bad, guys. And I'm like, no, fuck you. So
what are your strengths and what are his strengths? Like, how do you guys balance each other out
when it comes to like music,
comedy, friends, anything?
I don't know. I just, in a ways, we're a lot similar, but then we do have like polar opposites. Like, when it comes to music, I'm very all over the place, and he's very like, he reels me in. Like, he's the one that, like, he knows, like, all right, just go off on the guitar, right? And he'll let me get into my zone. But then he's like, okay, now take away about 80% of that. And I'm like, oh, all right, got it. He's like, because that's a lot. I'm like, right. Okay. But like, he's good at reeling me back into like, all we need is like 7 notes. I'm like, okay, I wanted to shred for a second, but all right, I got you. So we have a good balance of that. And sometimes it's the same thing with him, where he's like, sometimes something will be too simple and I'm like, no, screw it up a little bit, make it out of time or whatever. Yeah. And then, you know, so we're good at pushing and pulling each other in the right directions if something needs a little more or a little less. When it comes to comedy, we just have two completely different styles. Like, I'm more of I do like long-winded stories and stuff with like a bunch of jokes mixed in the middle. And Zeke's very much like a dry one-liner kind of guy.
I mean, so is there anything you can like look at him and his style and kind of adapt for yours?
You know what's funny? When I watch him, he reminds me to have fun. Because like, he will go up there sometimes and he'll just bail out of a joke halfway through and move on to something else and even acknowledge it and get a huge laugh from it because he's just so in the moment and just having a good time. And then like, there's something about his fun anxiety that gets everybody else into it and they start feeling his energy. And so he reminds me sometimes like, oh yeah, that's right, just have a good time and like laugh at yourself and who cares? It's supposed to be. I think sometimes because we take it so seriously, we forget it's supposed to be fun.
Right.
Like, you're supposed to have a good time. Don't stress yourself to the point that you're just like, you ruin it for yourself, you know?
I'll go back and look at old sets or, you know, just think about how I was a few years ago. And I'm like, man, I was way too rehearsed on that. Like, I look at myself now and I'm like, I'm having fun. I'm more conversational. I don't have this joke memorized yet, but I can go to a show and be like, hey, let's see what happens and work my way through it. And I think that's, you know, I've only been doing it about 8 years. So I think it's just a product of like, I'm more comfortable and I'm cheating. Like, I produce a lot of shows and I'm hosting them. So like, if I fuck up, I have another show. Like, I'm not worried about not getting booked by me. You know, that's not an issue. So I kind of play with a loaded deck. But yeah, I'm just more comfortable. And I think like for him probably, and I'm sure you too, but like if he's that comfortable, because he's running shit too.
Yeah, yeah.
He can fuck around a little bit more. He's got a little more freedom.
Yeah, and I just started producing shows this year. I've always like, I didn't want the stress of it. I just enjoy just having to worry about me getting booked and going from town to town and stuff. And so this year I just started producing. He's been producing shows for like 7 years, and so like now, like, I even told him, I was like, it's almost like going to your parents after you're a parent and apologizing for being a shitty kid. So I was like, I want to go to him, but dude, I didn't get it, but I get it now. My bad, dude, this is crazy.
What's the biggest lesson you've learned from producing?
Don't let the stress get to you, because there's been so many times where like I spent the 6 hours before the show like, man, we barely sold any tickets, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's going to hate me. I got to spend my paycheck now. I'm paying these comics. And then 30 minutes before the show, there's 35 people in the room. And I'm like, oh, shit, hey, I'm actually plus $60. This isn't that bad. Like, what the hell? And I was like, man, I could have almost gave myself a stomach ulcer today, like when it actually all ended up working out. So I try not to let the stress get to me. And I just realized, like, you know, just focus on one thing at a time and it'll all smooth out like peanut butter.
I got news for you. That feeling's never going to end. I don't, unless maybe Zeke, because like Zeke's working with like JP and like that collective. Like, so he's getting some of these bigger names too.
Yeah.
Like, cause is he still doing Music Box or no?
No, Music Box closed down, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
But like, he was at least dealing with some bigger names. So like, they're easier to sell. But like, as a local booker, it's like every show I do, I'm convinced, unless I sold a bunch pre-sale, I'm convinced that this show isn't going to work and these people will never work with me again. And I've been working with these guys, these comedians, for like 8 years. They're going to keep working with me. But I have it in my head saying, no, I'm a complete failure. I'm wasting their time. Meanwhile, they know the deal and they're appreciative for the stage time and the money I give them. So it's just it's a battle.
You forget too, like, cause I think sometimes like in my mind, I get stressed. I was like, man, I forget, or I'm like, for some reason, I'm like lying to myself. I'm like, man, like, do I really think every show on the rest of their tour dates is sold out or something in the middle of nowhere, Georgia? You know what I mean? Like, it's probably similar to this, like. And then the more you start traveling and going to other places, you realize you're like, oh, okay, like one night there's 45 people in a small room that only holds 30. And then the next time in a room that holds 80 people, there's 4 people there. And you're like, damn.
Well, I'll psych myself out with what I pay people. And like, my budgets aren't very big. So like an opening comedian, if I have a 4-person show, opener's probably making like $50 or so. And it's honestly not bad when you think about it, but it feels like an insult when your comedian is coming 2 hours away. And then I'll get an offer a little further away, 2.5 hours in Rochester for $25 or $50. I'm like, oh, wait, maybe my prices aren't that bad. Like, it's a little higher maybe. And then, you know, I've got that tip option so I can feel better about myself later. But I'm like, oh, okay, it's not all me. But I think the brain wants, I don't know if it's trying to insulate you or keep you down, but it's like you're doing it the wrong way until you're proven that it's not like your brain's just lying to you.
Yeah. No, I made the mistake of my first show that I produced. Like, I was like, this is how much I'm going to pay my comedians. And I did that.
Yeah.
And it was stressful because then I found out what all the other producers around the Gulf Coast are paying. I'm like, oh my God, I'm paying like way too much. So I'm like definitely cut down more. Because then I realized, like, oh, I tell them, I still say what I can pay. And people are like, oh, hell yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay, so I'm still in a great ballpark. I was like, no wonder everyone was so fucking excited for the first show.
Well, that's one thing, like, I told people who started producing, just started, and they'll tell me what they're paying, and in the back of my mind I'm like, you sure you want to do that? And like, as a comedian, I want all the money I can get, and I don't want to prevent anybody from getting what they're owed. But it's like, also, like, if you run out of money doing that way, there's no show. So like,
the
biggest thing I've told people is like, make sure you pay yourself and be okay with paying yourself, because the comedians are okay with you paying yourself as well.
Yeah, sure. And honesty is always the best policy. Like, nothing feels better than when you're trying to get a show in a new town and the producer's like, listen, man, I can only pay $30. You might not want to travel 5 hours to do this show.
Same thing. And it's like, please, like, don't be offended. I won't be offended if you say no, but all I can give you is $100. And most times, I'm like, yeah, that's cool. I'm like, all right. And I'll try to pay more. But like I always pay guarantee plus tip. And that plus tip has helped me out tremendously because it's not my money. I mean, essentially, it is for like 8 seconds that I've counted it until I put out a Venmo. But it's like, okay, they're saving my ass. Like, they make me feel like I'm a more competent producer.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you like producing?
There's things about it that I like. My favorite part has always been my favorite part. Like, in music, the band for them, a lot of the times will kind of let me pick the set list.
Yeah.
Because like that was like one thing that I studied for the longest time. Was like, I loved going to concerts and like looking at the set list and like how all the chords work together from song to song. Cause like, it really does like pink. Cause I'm big into jam bands too. So sometimes they'll slide into songs without stopping and stuff. And
that's
like
genetics.
Yeah. So like, I've always enjoyed just like how people produce a set list and give you the feeling like you kind of watched a movie through audio. you know? And so I enjoy building the lineups the most, like picking like who's going to be on the show, who goes best with this headliner, how can I keep things a nice mix though, so the audience, like, you know, because I like shows, I don't like shows where like it's all the same kind of comedian because the headliner's this kind of comedian. I want a show where it's like going into, you know, you sticking your hands into a thing of candy on Halloween and you got a bunch of different flavors of things. You know what I mean? I always enjoy that. So I like mixing and matching different stuff and like who's going to be the opener. And like, that's my favorite part, honestly, is building the list.
I love that. I keep track of all the shows I've done. And just so I don't, like, I try to vary up the lineups enough to where I'm not repeating people. I've got a bunch of venues, so like I have the luxury of doing that. And yeah, I want to create networking opportunities for other people as well. And that's one thing that's huge for me, because I don't know how your area is, how many areas you draw from, but like up here, we've got like 8 or 9 comedy scenes that are all within like 2.5-3 hours away. So
yeah,
I always like trying to like, okay, well, Paul hasn't worked with RJ. Let me put those guys together, because maybe Paul will like RJ enough to bring him on the road. Or if there's a spot in Buffalo and RJ is not that far, Paul will go there and bring RJ. Like, I like to be like the conduit to, you know, get other people gigs, because if I don't pay them enough, at least they got another perk out of going to my show.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we have a similar thing down here where it's like on the Gulf Coast, like on the line of the shore, like there's so many different scenes. So like 4 hours away towards the west, there's Lafayette, Louisiana with Jason P. Leonard. And then in between Lafayette and Mobile on that drive, you got New Orleans, you got Baton Rouge, you got Ocean Springs, Mississippi, Biloxi, Mississippi. And then you go east, you have Tallahassee, Florida, Panama City with Jason Hedden has a huge scene. You got Pensacola, Fort Walton has a comedy club. So like in either direction on the coast, you can every hour find a new scene, which is nice.
For you, what's a normal drive to go to a scene? Like what can you do? You're 10 years in, you're getting the gray hair already, but is a 2 hour drive too far? Is a 3 hour?
No. Okay. God, no. A goal of mine is I really one day want to get booked at the Laughing Skull in Atlanta. So I've made a decision that I'm going to go up there, do the open mic, and the very next day sign up again and get the date. And every 2 months or whatever, every 6 weeks, go up there and do the open mic as many times as it takes until I can get something there someday. I'm just like, the sobriety has taught me that. I was like, I got to write down some goals for myself that keeps your brain like focused on, you know, the right things. But that's a 6 hour drive. So it's like May 1st, I'm driving 6 hours to Atlanta and I have work the next day. So I'm driving six hours doing the open mic, driving 6 hours right when I get off stage and then going to work at 7 a.m. Like, so that's 12 hours round trip for free.
Oh man. See, I can't. And that's a product of being 40, 41. Like I can't do that anymore. And I could make the drive, but yeah. I won't let myself do that.
Yeah. And also, I get it, because, you know, there is that little bird in the back of my mind that's like chirping away, being like, man, if you hit 35 and you still don't get booked there, bro, just think about all the hours of driving you did to do that. But
I think more than that, for an open mic, like we have a good one in Buffalo where I'm like, okay, well, I should go. It's 3 hours away, though. My fear is that what if I bomb? And I have to drive 3 hours hating myself for driving the 3 hours there just to do 3.5-4 minutes of shitty material to nobody who's listening. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to see the way my brain works, what my brain will tell me on the way home.
Yeah, no, dude, I'll never forget one of the first time Jason P. Leonard ever booked me. I was like 22, 23 years old. So I was like 2 or 3 years into comedy. And he was like, tell you what, I'll let you be the headlining comic at this open mic.
Right.
Where like, they'll do the open mic and you get to close it out and do 20 minutes. And I'm like, all right, bet. And luckily, like one thing that I felt really lucky about starting out doing stand-up here 10 years ago in the Gulf Coast was our scene around everywhere was so small, you could get so much stage time. Like, if you could stand on stage and actually get a couple of laughs, you know, throughout your whole set or whatever, you know, there wasn't that many people. So people were throwing me 20-minute, 30-minute sets when I was only, like, 2 years in. Like, a lot. And like, I probably wasn't doing that great. You know what I mean? In my mind, I'm like, dude, this is great. I'm making it. But crowd's probably like, Jesus Christ, this 21 year old done 15 minutes on jacking off. Yeah, I drove 4 hours to Lafayette, Louisiana. I'm like, this is my first like headlining kind of show or whatever. And I ate it. It was so bad. From the moment I said hello to the moment I said goodnight, it was dead silent in the room. And it was packed in there. And everyone was just staring at me. Dude, I had so much sweat on my armpits. I was dying. And then Jason B. Leonard gave me my money. And I drove home in silence to just my GPS just being like, take a right on exit 87. And I'm just like, God damn, I hate myself so much right now. It was awful.
I usually ask everybody what their worst set was. Is that yours?
No. So, okay, I have two different worst sets.
Okay.
That I'll say real quick. The first one was I blacked out on stage. I was drinking really bad. I was supposed to open up for Chris Kattan that weekend. I ended up opening up for him doing 4 shows, but this is at Zeke's open mic at the Music Box. And I got hammered and I go on stage and I like took my shirt off. I screamed at the audience for like 10 minutes about Finding Nemo, like angrily yelling at them about Finding Nemo. I kicked this metal stool as hard as I could and it like flipped over and I like put a dent in my shin almost. And then I just sat down on the stage and just smoked a cigarette. And Zeke was like, yells. He's like, hey man, you can't smoke in here. And then I just yelled back in the mic, only you can kick me out. It was so bad, dude. Everyone was like, what the hell was that? And I went outside and Zeke just came up to me and he's like, hey, man, you're not going to do that this weekend with Chris Kattan, right? And I was like, no, I promise I won't. Those shows went really well, actually. But yeah, I guess I was having a bad day. This is why I don't drink anymore. So it's not good for me. It's not good for comedy. I don't get into like my Doug Stanhope level. I become like a cry for help on stage. But the other worst one was because I was killing so hard. I had a show in Tallahassee, Florida. I was like 5 years in. We were doing a tour and I was like headlining at the end, just doing like 20 minutes. And I'm 19 minutes into the best set of my life. Like I was riding this high. And I have this joke that I close with a lot where I talk about blaxploitation movies and there's a million different ways I say the word Jack because they always call people Jack in these movies. And so it is like a guitar solo of a joke. Like it's a lot to remember. And so I'm in 19 minutes into the best set of my life. I just got the light. I'm going to do the Jack joke. And I completely just flubbed it. And then it was dead silence in the room. And I was like, man, I'm going to start that one over. And I try to start over the whole thing and I screw it up again. And in the mic go, God damn it. Good night. And I put the mic in and then it ends with just like a golf clap from like 7 people. All that energy I built up just completely went out the window the moment I ruined that joke. It destroyed me for like 3 weeks. I couldn't. I still have nightmares about that. It was so bad.
I did a contest a few years ago and I had a great set. I don't know if I was going to win because it was out of town. So probably I was going for third place just to advance. Yeah. But I screwed up a joke that I'd done 100 times, never fucked it up. And I screwed it up twice because I caught myself the first time and then I screwed it up the second time. And I didn't restart the joke, but I fucked up 2 parts of it. And I finished fourth and that's all I thought about. I mean, I didn't even pay attention to the last 2 comedians because I was just in my head. I'm like, why did I do that? How did I do that? What's going on? And then the next time I did that joke, I fucked it up again because I was in my head.
Yes, dude.
So I'm like, I'm gonna shelve that for a little bit.
Dude, I'm pretty sure I was afraid to do that joke for like 2 months because I was like, what if that's like, what if my mouth just can't do that anymore? Like, what happened to me? Like, yeah, that like destroyed me, dude. That's the worst, especially when you have like a big like Carlin memorized like 500 word thing. Like if you mess up one part, dude, it can screw up because your brain is so triggered to remember that this word equals these next 40 words and then this word equals, so you mess up one of those words and all of a sudden you're like, what part am I at?
And
then it's comedy, just over with.
Comedy is all like word math. It's like,
yeah,
if you fuck up the order, if you stumble, if you stutter, it's going to take away a lot of the momentum. It's like, all right, well, yeah, fuck it. It wasn't even worth it. Like, I just wasted 45 seconds building this up, and it doesn't matter because it what I, like last night I did a show and I mean it just it's a weird situation, but I had a really good set, but like one of my early jokes didn't connect because what happened was I had two waiters standing right in front of me and yeah. I couldn't see anybody. So like that was in my head and I fucked up a joke that I had told for years and it's like a two line joke. And I fucked up the first part because all I could think about was, well, what do I do now? Like I'm in this joke and I've got two people right in front of me. Should I move over? Should I address this? I kept going through, but in that time I fucked up the first line and I recovered. Okay. I'm like, man,
yeah.
It didn't hit the way it hit, but it didn't hit the way it should have.
Yeah, dude. And you know, sometimes your mind plays your own tricks on you though, because I just did the Laughing Skull a couple weeks ago. And dude, I remember the moment I got off stage, I went outside and I called people and I was like, God damn it, dude, I just bombed. And they're like, really? And I was like, man, because you get 4 minutes. And I was like, the first 2 minutes was really good. And then the last 2 minutes, I just lost them. And they were like, damn, that sucks. And then I paid for the video. It's like $20 to get your video of your set. So I paid for it, and then I got the email like 6 days later, and I did not watch it for like a week. And I was at my buddy Curtis's house, and he was like, man, let's watch it. Let's see what it's like. I was like, ugh. So we played it, and it was actually really good. The first 2 minutes I knew was good. I thought the last 2 minutes I bombed horribly because I just remember hitting one punchline, and it was kind of silence in the room. But then I went back and watched the video, and it wasn't complete silence, and then I acknowledged it, and it got a big laugh. And I was like, oh, okay. See, I thought that was way worse than it actually was. So sometimes it made me realize, like, sometimes your mind can definitely play tricks on you with your memory. And, like, because you maybe on the way there imagined yourself murdering.
Right.
Like, if you don't murder, you're like, oh, I didn't do, you know, it was awful, blah, blah. Then you go back and watch it. Actually, it was pretty good. So that happened to me.
Yeah. I'm not sure our brains will ever, it's just, we're kind of fucked up. Like, so
yeah.
We're always going to think we did a little worse than we did. Like, I'll have a set where, like, I'll get off stage and my girlfriend will text me. She's like, how'd it go? I'm like, fucking terrible. And then I'll look at every joke I had in the set list. I'm like, actually, that joke was okay. That joke did pretty well. I like that joke. I like the response. So I'm like, oh, yeah, no, it was just one joke that didn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you've been at it 10 years and you're taking it seriously. This is your job now. Do you plan on staying there or are you – you're going to move, and if you can move, can you imagine being away from Zeke?
Yeah, eventually I think I would like to move. I mean, that would be a few years down the road, but eventually I would like to make a move to a bigger scene. But as far as Zeke, we'll be fine. You know what I mean? We have FaceTime like this, you know what I mean? So I can see him whenever I want, you know?
That's the one cool thing about technology. Like, I remember my buddies in college, like they moved to Minnesota and Ohio and Maryland. I'm like, well, I'm in New York, Pennsylvania. Like, I'm never going to see you again. Oh yeah. There's the option. Like now we can text all the time. You know, we don't have to rely on instant messenger. We both had to be by our computers. Like it's evolved. So it's like, yeah, we can be in the same room if we really want to.
Yeah. And the cool part about comedy also is like, you can always just call up some weird coffee shop in a small town and get some show together and then hit up your friend and be like, hey, you and two of your favorite comics down there, y'all want to do a show together at this place? Because I'll be in town for 3 days. Now you're all meeting up and having a good time again. And
then that becomes a tax write-off. So it's a business expense. Like, hanging out with Zeke is now, hey, it's going to help me get to a good place financially.
Yeah, now we're talking about starting a small business in a healthy way.
Well, this is so much fun. Thank you so much for talking.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This was awesome.
Do you have anything to plug? Anything coming up? Anything you're working on? Social media?
Yeah, for sure. So you can follow me on Facebook, Carson Taylor. If you need to look up location, Mobile, Alabama. On Instagram, I am Carson Taylor Comedy, CarsonTaylor. I'm half a producer for Whippersnapper Comedy, along with Josephine Rivera, who's from Pensacola, Florida. We do one show a month at a place called Cedar Street Social in Mobile, Alabama. So if you're ever in the area and you're looking for comedy and it's that time of the month for us, we have Neil Rubenstein.
Oh, nice.
And Abby Watusa and a bunch of great openers and, you know, local features around the Gulf Coast. So, should be a good time. And we do that once a month and, you know, just grinding and trying to make it happen one day at a time.
Is Pensacola that close? that it's
yeah. Pensacola is like 45 minutes to an hour away, and they have a great scene. They have this they have BTB comedy that's ran by Olivia Searcy and Delicia Nichols or Nicholas, and it is fantastic. All the shows that they run are amazing. We do Don't Tell Comedy down here and stuff, so it's fun.
I've had Delicia on the podcast too.
And yeah, she's awesome.
Talked about Hambo, her pig.
Yes. People think it's a joke at first, but it's like, no, dude, she's dead serious. She has a pig.
She said it so nonchalantly. And I'm like, what? She goes, I'll show you. And I was like, there's a goddamn pig on your couch.
Yeah, Delicia is the best, dude. She's one of the funniest people I've ever met. She definitely has she has a glow about her when she's on stage. She can, the slightest face expression or noise can get a huge laugh. And you're like, man, she just has an energy that just works on top of being a great writer. So
I know you kind of almost hate people like that. It's like, fuck you.
When I have to follow her, I find myself pulling on my make believe tie, like Ronnie Dangerfield. I'm nervous all of a sudden. I'm like, shit. I gotta throw up.
Oh man, thank you again so much, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you so much,
and we'll talk soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure. And hey, if you're ever down in the area, man, I'd love to have you on the show. So if you're ever swinging through or down in the Gulf Coast, hit me up, and we'll get you on a Whippersnapper show or find some mics for you to do.
If you're ever up in the Northeast, let me know, because I'll hook you up too.
Hell yeah, appreciate it, man.
Sweet, dude. I'll talk to you in a bit. Off and stacked some, peeling back my sunburnt skin. I'll wait outside your bedroom. I hope they let me in.